We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 15th of June, in the glorious future year of 2024. And I am coming to you by pre-recording so that I can go to the anime club meeting. Now, this, of course, is the show which Gemlog is apt to refer to as the ranty one. Truth is, it's often more rambly than ranty, and that's likely to be true this time as well. But what do I have for you? Well, first is mail call. Nice envelope here from Singapore, postmarked either 20th or 28th of May. I think it's 20th of May, with two nice stamps. One is of early 19th century Singapore, I believe, showing a bridge. I think that's what that is. And the other is of a very showy fish. The total of these two stamps appears to be $1.55 Singaporean, which is a great deal less than $1.55 US, which is what it would have cost to send the same thing the other way. But inside the envelope is a beautiful 19th century botanical print of the durian. Yes, durian king of fruits, year 1863. The famous king of fruits, Durio zibethinus, is native to the Malay archipelago. Known for its powerful odor, particularly strong-smelling variants are banned from public transport and hotels in Southeast Asia. Despite this, Alfred Russel Wallace was a fan, and described its taste as a rich custard highly flavored with almonds. This image was originally published in Belgium in the year 1863 by Bertha van Noten as one of a series of 40 Southeast Asian botanical lithographs depicting fruits and flowers. Okay, and who is the card from? It's from Stug! What does Stug say? Just a note, to add Singapore to your list of places to receive post from, I have smelt plenty of durian in the markets, but resisted the urge to try. I have suffered enough durian goodies brought back to the office by friends and colleagues. However, I do not like it. Thanks for all the great items postal so far. It all adds into making life a touch less dull. Best wishes, Stug. Oh, thank you, Stug. I'm glad to know I make your life a touch less dull. Second piece of mail here is from another Anon-Radio DJ. Yes, Stug has a show, 20 hours UTC Thursdays, called Flux. Pretty good time. But yes, here is one, postmarked June 6th, which arrived enclosing my favorite bearer instrument, a United States Postal Service domestic money order, with the notation, "For to further the cause or do crimes at your discretion." And I'm sure that the fellow Anon Radiator who sent me that will be glad to know that the first thing I did with the money was drive over to the Daiso. They opened a Daiso in Fort Worth just a couple of weeks ago, and it's more or less on the same street as the post office I go to, although far enough away that you actually have to pass by another post office before you get there. Anyhow, and I purchased some magnets. The specific purpose I had in mind for those magnets was to hold a sheet of cloth or paper over the window in my bathroom to turn it into an impromptu darkroom so that I could continue my experiments with cyanotypes. And I have been continuing them, so far with less than notable success. But we'll see, I have yet to try the drafting vellum, which is, I think, a polyester film roughened on one side to accept ink and pencil. I believe that I should be able to coat that roughened side with the cyanotype chemicals, in which case I can expose it from the back side and use the back side as the outer surface of a pinback badge without having to use the Mylar cover film, which is essentially the same material as the drafting vellum. Now, if you're wondering about the logic of using magnets to hold something over a window, the secret to this is that I drove some thumbtacks into the wall surrounding the window. So the magnets are meant to be attracted to the thumbtacks, which are made of steel. As I say, progress on that is not completely encouraging so far. I like to think I'll find a suitable paper that's not super heavy, or else that the drafting film approach will work. Progress with other things. I know I mentioned Jim Log before. I want to thank him for reminding me that I had forgotten to take the text Preliminary Version Not Revised off of the back of the PDF version of BLAST, which is on the website. And of course, you can navigate either to atomicblah.st or to blast.man-and-atom.info. Takes you to the same place either way. Other things to do with information on the web. I have been working through scanning the issues of the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority's monthly magazine Atom, which I have. The issues I have range all the way from 1966 to 1984, but there are only a couple of years for which I have anything resembling full coverage, and there are several years for which I have nothing at all. In addition to scanning them, I have also been typing up some of what I consider the more interesting portions, letters to the editor and book reviews in particular. So that kind of thing is going up on the Man and Atom website. It's currently not linked from the website homepage because I'm still dithering about exactly how I want to do that. But I will put a link to the index of scanned issues of Atom, which also includes brief content summaries for each issue and scans of covers and that kind of thing. I will put a link to that into the AnonRadio.net archive page for A Step Farther Out this week. As you know, I do a weekly page on AnonRadio.net specifically for the contents of each week's Step Farther Out programs. Now, as I may have mentioned, I am planning, if I possibly can, this autumn to pay a visit to the Ringhals nuclear power station in southern Sweden. And I may have to rent a car in Gothenburg in order to drive out there. If I do, I'm going to try to make sure I rent a battery electric car, so that I can drive up, park it in front of the power plant, and just plug it in directly. If I manage to do that, and I think that kind of thing is hilarious, I've done it at a hydro plant, I will try to get a photo. Couple of pieces of space news. You may already have heard that it looks as though Elon Musk is going to get his $56 billion payday from Tesla. He says that's what he needs in order to go to Mars. He may well be right. Of course, there's a difference between going to Mars and arriving alive, and even if you do arrive alive, surviving beyond a few months. Again, I think my plan is superior, that I want to go somewhere that's only 3 days away, which means that when things go wrong, as I like to say, failure is not an option, it's inevitable. When things go wrong, it's easier to recover from them. Couple of notable deaths here in the last month or so. Anita Gale is not necessarily a name you know. She was an engineer in the early shuttle program, worked for Rockwell, worked for Boeing, and in recent years involved at a high level with the National Space Society. I knew her when I was on the board of the NSS, and she was also involved very much with the local NSS chapter in Clear Lake near Houston after she had moved down there from Seattle, although she still supported the Seattle sports teams. Anyway, she died of pancreatic cancer in May, quite suddenly, as often happens. And certainly a great loss to the space community. She was very much involved with everything, and also an excellent hostess. she used to hold movie nights and arrange parties and other gatherings for the Clear Lake chapter. And despite my instinctual reluctance to go to Houston, I did enjoy her hospitality a couple of times. And then Dr. Ed Stone of the California Institute of Technology and its associated Jet Propulsion Laboratory has passed away at the age of 88. Dr. Stone is perhaps best remembered for having been, lo these 50 years, chief project scientist for the Voyager missions. And it was his initiative to hold live press events where scientists, science fiction writers, and others would comment on the data as they came in from Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, which was really very clever as a way of engaging the public. So, Dr. Stone was a scientist of repute and also one of those people who has the knack for getting non-specialists engaged, which is so very important. Now, my nominal topic for this show is, as I always say, technology and the future of humanity, and mostly not computers. Certainly, biotechnology, biological and biomedical technologies, always of interest. And in that vein, a Chinese group has reported that they have successfully cultured pancreatic islet cells, say it with me, islets of Langerhans, from a person's own stem cells, specifically, as they point out, non-tumorigenic stem cells, because the thing that sort of gets mumble-mumbled in a lot of stem cell-based research is that when you have a pluripotent cell line, it's actually quite difficult, in many cases, to get it to restrain itself and not try to take over everything in sight. Many attempted stem cell therapies have done nothing better than cause a new and interesting kind of cancer. But in this case, they have succeeded in convincing these stem cells to differentiate into pancreatic islet cells and then injected them into the patient in such a way as essentially to cure insulin-dependent diabetes. That's really impressive. And it's only been 100 years since the successful first treatment of patients, mostly children, who were dying in agony of diabetic ketosis in a hospital in Toronto with insulin. It was, in the accounts of those who were there at the time, nothing short of miraculous. If this proves to work in the longer term, as well as the first indications suggest, it looks as though we may finally be able to fix things so that folks with insulin-dependent diabetes can make their own insulin in their own bodies in response to their own need for insulin, thus eliminating the whole regime of finger pricks and test strips and syringes and pumps and ports and all of that nonsense. So, my congratulations to Wu Jiaying and colleagues at the Shanghai Institute of Biochemistry and Cell Biology and the Shanghai Changzheng Hospital. But I have to say that one aspect of this topic, technology and the future of humanity, is, of course, the question, what is humanity? Who are we? How do we define ourselves? How do we understand ourselves? Because, ultimately, no matter what we invent, no matter what we discover, those questions and the answers we find for them will govern how we apply those inventions and discoveries, what we apply them to, whether they build us up or whether they tear us down. And in a world which, coming on 80 years since the first atomic bomb, is still racked with war, those are still very vital concerns. And so, in that regard, I was quite taken aback by a quote that showed up in the Wall Street Journal. It matters very little who the person is they're quoting. I have remarked in the past that many of the things that capital B business people do and say seem to me like symptoms of a mental illness. Which is not to say that I think they're in business because they have a brain lesion or a chemical imbalance, but rather that modern business itself behaves to some extent functionally as a mental illness. And it's hard for me not to believe this when I read of someone saying, quote, "I wake up in the morning for one purpose, to elevate super prime real estate." Now, coming from a Christian background, from a specifically Roman Catholic background, I can't help immediately comparing that with the Lorica of St. Patrick. "I arise this day through a confession of the oneness, through an invocation of the threeness, of the creator of creation." You know, if you're getting up in the morning with one singular purpose, it makes sense if that thing is outside of and above man, the way that divinity is conceived of as being. You don't even have to believe in God to see that arising in the morning, focused on something that is outside and above yourself, has an ennobling character. But elevating super prime real estate? How is that a fit reason for a human being to exist? I can't help somehow but connect this with the disappearance of the contemplative monasteries, which were such an important feature of the Middle Ages, which were across Europe either swept away by the Protestants in the 16th and 17th centuries, or done away with by nominally Catholic reformers in the 18th and 19th centuries. Congregations of people whose entire occupation, what they did with themselves, was to contemplate man and God and themselves and the state of the world. It seems to me that we have reached an opposite pole from the contemplative monasteries of the Middle Ages, when it is possible for someone to say that he gets up every morning for one singular purpose, to elevate super prime real estate. We have here a person who has made the focus of his life, has made, if you will, his God, something that doesn't even benefit him. One can have sympathy, at least, for the person who makes an idol out of some temporal thing which is of benefit, right? I don't cease to praise the great Basil Get and his sewer system in London, and to remark that the pumping engines in the sewer system were named for members of the royal family at the time. There is someone who is, both literally and figuratively, elevating the lowest thing that there is, right? Sewage. Human waste. Doing so for the benefit of the people of the great metropolis. And the benefit of that work continues to this day. His drains are still in use in London, and the fact that he oversized them by an almost ludicrous figure is what has allowed London to keep growing upwards as it has. So I can have great respect for Basil Get, who for years on end got up every morning to elevate sewage. But someone who says that he gets up every morning to elevate super prime real estate? I really feel that he has lost his way. He has lost the sense of what it is to be a human being, which is one of the worst things a person can conceivably lose. And for some reason, this makes me think of something that happened the other day, and that ties in with a bit of family history. I may have mentioned that my grandmother, my father's mother, is 100 years old. Well, I noticed the other day that my mother had some medical scrub tops, and I asked her what that was about, and she explained that the aide who comes in every week to help grandmother with her bath needed some alterations done on her scrub tops, and so mother was going to do them for her. And this put me in mind of a bit of family history, because my mother's mother, although not in many ways a particularly admirable person, had at least one trait that I would call exceptional because so many so-called good people seem to lack it, and which my mother also has, and which I really hope that I have. Grandmother did not believe that there was such a person as a menial. People might be doing menial tasks, but that did not mean anything morally. And the illustration of that, which I always remember, involves the cleaning lady that they had. Cleaning lady, mother's help, maid, whatever you want to call her. Grandmother was raising 7 children in the 1960s, and they had a woman come in several days a week to help with household chores and that kind of thing. And this being 1960s Dallas, she was black. And she came one day and said, "Ma'am, would you allow me to use your washing machine? I'll pay you what I would pay the laundromat. I'll bring my own soap," but the problem was, essentially, that, again, 1960s Dallas, super segregated. There were no laundromats convenient to her that allowed black people. Well, grandmother was very offended by this. She says, "You will not pay me for loads of laundry you do here. You do not have to bring your own soap. You're washing my family's clothes. You can wash your family's clothes right alongside them." I will tell you, there were a lot of families in Dallas, white families who employed black housekeepers, who would never have said anything of the kind. People who might seem far more admirable in many respects than my mother's mother, who, as I say, had some very serious personal failings, which did affect the people around her. But that was one quality in which she was head and shoulders above many of the people around her. She did not believe that there was such a thing as a menial person. And that idea that there is somehow a large population of proletarians, of menial people, of people who have no aspirations, people who have no dreams, people who don't have the capacity for it, not just people who've had it beaten out of them by life, but people who don't have the capacity for it, shapes our world in many ways, and I just don't believe it's true. You know, opposition to things like unconditional basic income, in many cases, rests on this idea that there are menials all around us, and if they're not forced to toil for their daily bread, well, they'll just make trouble, and so on. It's something resembling Aristotle's doctrine of natural slaves. And I can't help but connect that with the political pressure against nuclear power in Britain from the 1950s onward, which was nominally meant to protect coal mining jobs. Now, coal mining jobs are notoriously dirty and dangerous and poorly paid, and coal mining is not necessarily the kind of work anybody would want to be in if he had another choice. So protecting coal mining jobs really seems like a backwards notion to me. You know, the Drax coal-fired station in Yorkshire, which I often talk about because it's now partly fired by wood, and that wood is responsible for destroying valuable forest in North America, was built specifically to support employment in coal mines. The Central Electricity Generating Board wanted to build nuclear stations. The government of the time said, "No, you must build coal-fired stations because we want to support employment in the coal industry." So when I say that those coal mining jobs were preserved specifically by continuing to pollute the environment by burning coal, I'm not speaking in a generic way or hypothetically. I'm saying specifically that this happened. And then what was it all for? I think to a great extent, you know, successive labor governments just kept backing away from the idea of industrial retraining schemes and so on, which would allow gradually closing the less productive coal pits while finding the people who had been working there other employment, typically more lucrative employment, employment with a lower chance of accidental death and dismemberment, employment with a lower chance of chronic illness, employment which would leave them with more free time and more energy to use in that free time so that they could build up their communities and their families and themselves, right? And successive conservative governments, I'm afraid, weren't interested in doing anything about it because they viewed the coal miners as beneath them, as menials. Finally, rather than gradually moving people out of the coal mining industry as nuclear energy took over the job of coal, which was sort of the position envisioned by the 1955 White Paper, A Program of Nuclear Power, Instead, it comes down to the mid-80s, and Margaret Thatcher, exploiting the public weariness over repeated coal strikes, simply shuts down the entire British coal industry in order to neutralize the coal miners' unions as a political force. Bam! Just like that, all of those people whose jobs had been preserved by not switching to nuclear power, thrown out of work. Britain didn't stop burning coal, but then now they were burning coal being shipped from Australia. And for much of their energy needs, they wound up burning North Sea oil and gas, which, of course, only added to the bad economic position of Britain, because they could have sold that oil and gas overseas if they had built all the nuclear power plants that had been planned, including the fast breeder reactors, so that Britain's electricity supply was large and mostly not based on fossil fuels. But I object to the classification of people as menials, because I do believe that each and every human being possesses the spark, the image within them of the invisible God. But then I go back to this guy who says, "I wake up every morning with one sole purpose, to elevate super prime real estate," and I'm thinking, that guy is saying very explicitly that he is doing his utmost to efface the image of the invisible God within him, to turn himself into the thing which the working class and the poor are falsely judged to be. And that is very, very disquieting to me. We cannot build a world fit for human beings. We cannot take the opportunities that the cosmos presents us if we are engaged in wiping out the noblest parts of our own human nature, in lowering ourselves to be what the academic economists think we are, profit-maximizing machines or what have you. We must embrace humanity in all its color and disorder and messiness and wonder, so that we can comprehend within ourselves the cosmos in all its glory and majesty and order and messiness and wonder. Well, I don't know if that was ranty enough for you. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America, and hopefully I'll receive them sometime. When I do, I'll probably read them out on the air. I'll probably send you something in return. And, of course, gifts of support are always appreciated. If you don't feel like sending cash through the mail, or, as I mentioned, United States Postal Service domestic money orders, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam for a recurring contribution, which really does help support the things that I am doing. And coming up next on Anon Radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System, one of the oldest things on the internet, with its birthday coming up tomorrow, is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, which airs every single day at 19:30 UTC. Again, I'm Publius. I am with you at 15 UTC Tuesdays and Fridays for Hear Now the Words, the show on which I mostly read, and 19 UTC Saturdays with this program, A Step Farther Out, in which I talk about whatever I think is interesting, but particularly technology and the future of humanity, and mostly not computers. Take it away, Tobe!
Sound show, where we do genre mix, discussion, interviews, and avant-garde guitar. Only a few more seconds. You can take it.
Six, five, four, three, two, one,
cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out, your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. This is a substitute show to make up for the live show that I did not do, because I had somehow gotten it into my head that I could do a live broadcast while I was putting on the Nuclear Science Day event at the Dallas Makerspace. Which turned out to be a complete
7, 6,